So welcome, everyone. This is our January 20th chapter meeting for the Santa Clarita chapter. Today's speaker is Captain Scott Tate, now retired from the U.S. Navy. Captain Tate was able to captain, he's a commanding officer of the USS Zumwalt, which we have a picture of behind me. This is a transformational craft that entered the U.S. Navy. And so during his tour, you know, the ship transitioned from, you know, the pre-commissioning unit up in Maine, up in Bath, Maine, and somehow he got it to the Pacific. So maybe he can tell us how he got there. The USS Zumwalt is maybe arguably the most transformational naval boat into the U.S. Navy that has occurred since maybe the beginning of the 20th century. There's some references to what the Royal Navy did with the USS Dreadnought, which was the first steam-powered, U.S. Actually, it was a naval for the British, actually. It wasn't for the U.S. Navy. So that was back in 1906. So here we are in the 21st century, 2020, and to be excited to talk about this technology. The ship incorporates a whole host of new technologies, and I know Captain Tate will go through that. Lots of lessons learned, I'm sure, in providing a disruptive technology into probably some very traditional systems and dealing with the people that have to man these wonderful craft through our oceans. Captain Tate will give a background of some of the technologies and then some of the things that he had to face in providing a disruptive technology. I'm on the technology side as well, so there's lots of disruption in what we do, from our smartphones to artificial intelligence. We have Tesla cars now flying down the 5, now I guess autonomously, or sometimes autonomously. We're talking about, vertical takeoff aircraft. You're hearing about Uber, Lyft, and some of the disruption that's going on. So we're really excited about the disruption that will occur in aerospace and defense, and not including, manufacturing as well. I know, Jeff, we talked about additive and what that will do to the manufacturing space as well. So I think this theme is really exciting and really relevant to those of us in the aerospace and defense industry. We also want to thank Captain Tate for his service as well. And I'd like to take a moment to say those men and women that keep us safe through our oceans and through our air do a tremendous job. So we want to thank Captain Tate for his service. So with that, Captain Tate, we'll hand it over to you.
Excellent. Thanks, Rob. Thank you, Ivan, for all that you're doing with ADF and for the opportunity to come talk to you all today. I apologize up front for my voice. I'm coming off a cold. I have a 9-year-old who's a little petri dish and manages to somehow bring home anything that shows up at her school and promptly hand it off to me. This is really kind of two presentations rolled into one, and the goal is to both amuse and entertain and maybe inform a little bit, but also to give you some takeaways that I think are particularly relevant in today's world of peer competition and what I'll call hybrid warfare. Because we had a truly unique vantage point in Zumwalt by having a lot of military and a lot of industry, and then some of the government contract folks that lie in between, working closely together. So we got to see the Chinese coming at all three of us from different approaches. And it really, if you don't believe the world has changed, you'll have to look around. So I was blessed with a 27-year career in the Navy. Grew up in Detroit, never expected to see much south of Ohio. Went to University of Michigan, decided I wasn't going to be able to pay for that by myself, so I joined the NROTC unit, and the rest is kind of history. Just kept hitting one thing after another that looked fascinating. But I was really blessed in that my operational tours were very operational. Spent of my 27 years, I think 18 of them were at sea, and almost all of that was overseas, to include 13 years living in Asia, 4 years living in Europe, and then more time in the Middle East than I want to remember. But combatant ship background, you can see the frigates, the old Spruance-class destroyers, a couple of Ticonderoga-class cruisers, commanded USS Mustang, one of the Arleigh Burke destroyers, and then was blessed to go to be the first really operational commander of the Zumwalt. And then ashore, I was also lucky to have some truly unique assignments, mostly working directly for 3- and 4-star officers, doing tech and innovation or policy. So my last shore position was as department head for Northeast Asia and China, the Joint Staff. spending about 2 days a week over at the White House briefing the National Security Council and the principals and deputies. So we're here to talk about Zumwalt. And as Rob mentioned, when you really look at the history, the last time any Navy tried anything this crazy, it was HMS Dreadnought back in 1906. And we went a couple steps even further than the British did. The traditional development path, the Navy usually tries one, maybe two truly unique technologies that are categorized as such in a new class of ships. And the general pattern is it will put a new propulsion system into a well-known hull and weapon system, or we'll put a new weapon system onto a pretty well-known propulsion system, but don't try to do both at once, right? So in Zumwalt, they did 12. There are 12 different technologies that are identified by the Navy as new, different, revolutionary, whatever, that are built into the ship. And some of that is it's just spread throughout the ship. So we went with a new hull, entirely new hull form, new propulsion system, new crew concept, a lot of types of automated damage control, things that just hadn't been tried before. So the crew, the good news is that the crew got to do a lot of experimentation that they normally wouldn't, because there are no rules and regulations written for the thing yet. So they left a lot of it up to us to figure out, which was both an opportunity and a curse. It takes a while to do something like this. So the history of these ships really goes back to 1992. They were originally the replacement for the Iowa-class battleships. Everybody loved the old Iowa class, but they were super expensive to maintain. They had, even after modernization, still required 1,100 humans to run them. All the replacement parts had to be built pretty much from scratch off of prints that were drawn in the 1930s, because the industries that had supported those ships were gone. So we made the decision they had to go, but we still had the legal requirement to support the Marine Corps in amphibious landings. So the original design of the ship was about supporting Marine landings with heavy gunfire. I'll talk a little bit about the weapons in a minute, but suffice it to say that the 2 6-inch guns in Zumwalt as designed can provide the same level of firepower that the 9 16-inch guns on the Iowa class could, but at 3 times the range. So pretty formidable gun system. Yeah. However, in the 20 years of designing and building, the world changed around her a lot. So when I got ordered to the ship, I knew two things. First, that everything I'd probably read about it was wrong, because we were caught in the middle of a lot of politics, and people were either, I would say, falsely optimistic or falsely pessimistic, and that there was simply no training for these. So I asked to go meet as many of the people that were still in the system that had helped design her in the early days, so I at least understood what the vision was, what they'd gone into this thing planning, and we'd have a good understanding as we took the ship to sea of what the deltas were from what was originally intended and what we actually had. And the two things that really impressed me were that the folks that had designed her back in the early 90s came at this thing with an extreme humility about where the technology was going to go, and extreme humility about where the world was going to go strategically. So they knew it would take a long time to get them in the water, and they knew that the world was going to change, but they weren't arrogant enough to predict how. And they dealt with both of those problems in the same way. They built in an enormous amount of excess in all regards of what could possibly be needed, trusting that future generations of sailors would make use of that. So the computing capacity, the electrical power generation, just space, cooling, weight and moment, about 300% of what she was originally anticipated to need is what they built into her. And in fact, that played out to be very much on our favor, because we have used a lot of that excess capacity in all of those areas, which I'll talk about in a minute. So in 2013, they brought together the pre-commissioning unit, which is really where you build the crew, even though you don't have the ship yet. I got there late in 2015, just before her first real sea trials. We delivered her in early 2016, commissioned in October in Baltimore on the way around to the Pacific. We did get her to the Pacific, although if you Googled her, you'll find that we had a little issue with some coolers in the Panama Canal. Turns out that you have something in salt water for a long time, then you flush it out with fresh water, like is in the lakes there. Sometimes you have problems. And as we got her to San Diego, the real challenge was figuring out where was she going to fit in the fleet. Because there was this general sense in the Navy that, yeah, we built them, but we may be building them just to keep the Bath Ironworks alive. We don't really have a place for them. We know that the Marine Corps mission is probably gone, because the Marines are no longer landing on beaches. They're using Ospreys to fly over them. And even as good as their guns are, they don't reach far enough to support somebody who's in an Osprey. Excuse me. So what do we do with these ships? So that kind of became our biggest challenge, not only getting her into the fleet as a ship, but figuring out where she fit in the fleet as a tactical unit. And as it turns out, as Bismarck hinted, there's a lot of providence in fate for the United States, because these are exactly the right ships for the Navy at this time, this point in history. So building these ships was something to see. If you ever get a chance to go up to Bath, Maine, I recommend both the Maritime Museum there and a shipyard tour if you can get in. They design these things, so what you see when you get there is a lot of beams and plate coming in one end of this vast industrial hall, and then they build them into units, but they build them upside down. And the reason for that is strictly economic, because by union rules, if you're welding above waist level, there's a 30% to 50% premium, depending on the type of welding you're doing, both because of the increase of injury from burning stuff falling on you and the long-term effects of your back. I would never have guessed that, but they've dealt with that by designing the entire ship to be built upside down. Then they take it out into this open area, have the two crane system that flips it over, roll it back into another industrial hall where they knit them together into what are called ultra units. So the units that come out of the first process may be anywhere from 100 to 500 tons, maybe as big as 1,500 tons. Then they move them into the ultra process where they essentially build cross sections of the ship. And by the time they come out of there, they could be anywhere from 4,000 to 6,000 tons. Those roll out onto these. You can just kind of see it in this picture. These rolling supports that they then move on to what's essentially a floating dry dock, and then when it's ready, they just lower the dry dock into the Kennebec River and float the ship off. So a far cry from the way they used to do it, where you'd see the ship sliding down the ways into the water. Pretty neat process. But you get a sense of the size of the ship. She is called a DDG for political reasons. So we have designators for ships that are agreed with NATO, mainly so that naval planners, when they see a ship designation, have a general sense of what type of ship they're getting. So in airplane terms, you think F-15, you know it's a fighter. Fighters come with a radar weapons package. Ships are the same way. So DD is a destroyer, which is generally something that escorts other ships. CGs are cruisers. If you have a G on the end, it means it's guided missile capable. So DD or DDG, destroyer, or one with missiles. CG, same way, cruiser. We retired the BB designator, battleship, with the Iowa class, and because we'd done such a good job of convincing Congress that battleships were too expensive, we figured they were too dumb to ever let us build another. It would be too hard to explain to them that we were going to build a cheap one, so we retired that designator, even though these are closer to the battleship than they are destroyers. At the point that these were introduced, the Navy had another generation of cruisers they wanted to build. We knew the Congress wasn't going to give us two different types of cruisers, so they called it a destroyer out of convenience. But by comparison, the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers are about 8,500 tons. These things are 17,000 tons. So they're really a lot closer to the old heavy cruisers of the battleships than anything else. So there's kind of an overview. Up here, you've got a lot of sensors, communications, and weapons. We'll talk about some of the characteristics that drive our tactical employment in a minute. But just to look at the ship herself, you got a big flight deck back there, three times the size of any other combatant in the fleet. That was originally made that way because they knew they'd have to replenish those guns if she was going to be on the firing line supporting Marines for a long period of time. Carry 600 rounds, but can shoot that in 30 minutes, so you knew you were going to have to be replenishing her constantly. Turns out we use that flight deck for a lot more now. You can see the two 6-inch guns along the deck here and back here. You've got 80 missile tubes. Again, a lot of excess capacity. They've got adapters in them right now so that they can carry the same canisters that the rest of the fleet carries in terms of Tomahawk standard missile, the Apollo Sea Sparrow, and the vertical launch anti-submarine rocket, which is a torpedo and a booster. But they're substantially bigger than any other launcher in the fleet, so they're sized up for hypersonics and whatever's going to come next. They built her to take a punch. She's designed in four sections. Roughly right there, right there, right there, and then the back. Each of those four sections has its own power, its own cooling, its own computing capacity. They all cross-connect to mutually support, but she's designed to be able to lose two of those zones and still continue to fight. Most of the other ships in the fleet are about 3/4 of an inch thick. She's up to 4 inches in places, and most of that has a couple inches of Kevlar behind it. And she's built out of HY-80 and HY-100, which are what we make submarines and aircraft carrier flight decks out of, rather than the steel that the rest of the fleet has built. Areas where you don't have the thick armor, what they did was bring the ballast tanks up, so you've got about 15 feet of water. So again, it's back to the battleship design, what they used to take a huge armored box and then just build a hull around it. They kind of went back to that. She is electric drive, so she has Rolls-Royce turbines, but they only create electrical power. In other combatant ships, we use turbines to drive the shafts, which is very inefficient because the turbine needs to alternate speed anywhere from 5,000 to about 15,000 RPM in order to drive the shaft between 50 and 150 RPM. So inefficient, shortens the life cycle. Here, because you're just turning generators, she's super efficient, so she burns about as much fuel as a ship half her weight. And then having the electricity, 78 megawatts total, so on order of just slightly more than what a Nimitz-class carrier produces. To put it in more layman's terms, about 50,000 average American homes. She uses less than half of that to run around and operate everything, so when you start to look at directed energy, railguns, some of the other stuff that's coming down the pipe, these are probably the ships that will go on first. Oops. Can carry up to 3 helicopters, normally carries 2, designed to also carry unmanned vehicles. Underneath that flight deck is a big open boat bay. She has 2 11-meter special operations configured boats and can also carry the SEAL's new low observable boats. Let's see, what else?
Radar cross-sections.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. So they went a long way to reducing not only her radar cross-section, but her thermal, magnetic, and acoustic signatures as well. So what we can say publicly is that her radar cross-section is about 1/50th of the next smallest ship. Here we go. So design concepts. That top line there should be probably bolded out in about 10 times the font because it matters more than everything else put together. As we started to work with the ship and really understood its capabilities and figure out how it was going to fit in the fleet, having such reduced signatures, that becomes her primary defense. And if you don't have to carry a lot of defensive weapons, you can fill all those tubes with offensive weapons and you can go hunting. So I'll talk about the remissioning in a little bit, but in simplest terms, when we realized how good the signature was and what that meant, instead of having these ships escort carriers or do something traditional destroyers do, it made a lot more sense to pair them up with submarines and send them out way ahead of the fleet to start to open the door for everybody else, especially in a world that's dealing with anti-access types of technologies. I would put just her signature against all of our active defenses any day in terms of survivability. We talked about survivability in terms of, can she take a hit? Yes, she can. Increased efficiency, excess capacity. Now, the reduced crew size was driven by economics. Something like 60% of the Navy budget goes to humans, both active duty and retired and medical and all the other things that go with that. So it is an absolute imperative if we're going to modernize technologically and build out a fleet that can take on the Chinese and Russians that we reduce the number of humans in the Navy. They did that in a rather drastic fashion here. She's about twice the size of a regular ship and has half the crew. And without much experience in the fleet or much of a training pipeline, these sailors come on 3-year orders and it takes about a year for them to become qualified to do their job. So you've got 30% turnover and 30% in training, which means 30% of 150 is running the ship at any given time. So there's a lot of empowerment of junior people in ways that they wouldn't see elsewhere in the Navy today. So essentially an offensive platform. And talk about that in a second. So the people.
Sorry. Excuse me. One of the things I also thought the gender distribution is a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially so.
So the gender distribution has been accidental. On most Navy ships, you come with a legacy berthing design, and there are these big bay berthings where you might have anywhere from 40 to 100 people living in them. And so they designate one, maybe two of those as female berthing, and then once you hit that number, you're kind of tapped out and you can't take any more female sailors. On Zumwalt, because of the amount of size that she has, they went with a stateroom design. So you've got 4-person bunk rooms, which gives us a lot more flexibility in how we move people around and pair them up. So you can get any gender mix you want on these ships without having to disrupt, you know, the berthing design. Yeah. But when I left a year ago, she was about 30% female, and I'll be surprised if they don't get up around 50%, just because of the birthing flexibility and the fact that a lot of what's going on, you know, let's face it, the brute strength that you need guys for, most of that's automated on here, and if the automation fails, you're done anyway. So
my perception was that, that many females had senior level positions on the ship.
They did, yeah. We had two department heads, several division officers, and quite a few chief petty officers that were female. So this is, I think, relevant to industry as well as the Navy. As you know, Zumwalt has about 30,000 sensors and remote automated operating things scattered around the ship on our network. By comparison, the Nimitz class carrier has about 3,000. It's by far the most complex network afloat today, and it's designed to deal with that lower crew number to do a lot of things on its own. So the way the Navy traditionally operates is we establish the processes that the engineers propose for equipment operation. You understand the parameters, you understand what the signals are going to be that something's gone wrong, and you train people to respond so that every time they get that stimulus, they have the same response. So we've kind of narrowed it down to this is what could happen, these are the right responses, now just go do that. In Zumwalt, it's much more education. The people have to understand the system and work with it rather than operating it. And so creating that sort of human-machine teamwork was a big culture leap for the Navy. You can't just pull out a checklist and go down the checklist when something bad happens because the ship has already acted on the stimulus. It's going to react faster than you can. The sailor's job is now to figure out, is it reacting to the core problem or a symptom? Because there were a number of people that designed the systems in the ship, and the Navy decided to be its own integrator, which is not something we do well. So there are tons of areas where the operating tolerance band of one system that impacts another system might be much broader. So think of cooling systems that impact computer systems. Quite often, because the computer system has a much narrower tolerance for heat load, the computer system would trip, the ship would react to that. The real problem was over here in an airbound cooling system. So it could be one or two systems or three systems removed where the real core problem is, and the sailors had to get smart enough understanding the system of systems that they were essentially perpetually integrating the systems that were well-designed in their own but not designed to work well together.
Would this be a perfect time to talk about the famous plastic box?
I would love the plexiglass box. So on the bridge of the world's most advanced warship, we had a little plexiglass box. If you've been following the two collisions, the Navy fell in love with touchscreen controls for several years. Zumwalt is a product of that. So the main ship control console is all touchscreen. You move the rudder with your finger, you move the engines with your fingers. The guys who designed that were also sailors, so they knew that at some point that thing was going to break. So they gave us mechanical throttles as a fallback and a mechanical wheel as a fallback. What they didn't tell us is that they were also smart enough to realize that if the screen froze, you couldn't actively transfer control, so they designed it so that as soon as you move the throttles, you've just taken manual control. And during one of our it was on the transit. We're clipping along at about 20 knots, and all of a sudden the ship went to zero, and it took us 6 or 7 hours of troubleshooting to figure out that what had really happened is a kid had reached over to grab his Coke and bump the throttles and put her into manual control at zero speed. So the solution to that was a plexiglass box so that you couldn't bump the throttles. And there's just a number of these things. One of the things that the Navy cut was all of the operating manuals and training manuals as we faced budget crunches. So when we moved aboard the ship, we only had 3.5 months from the time the Navy took delivery, which was really the first time the sailors were allowed to go aboard the ship and operate the equipment, until the day we sailed away. And a good deal of that was trial and error, learning how to operate the systems from scratch and developing our own operating stuff that we could use to train the our own SOPs that we could train the next generation. So I hinted at this. what was originally going to be a gunship platform just didn't make sense, and as we started to play with what she could do and what the Navy needs today, this mission of becoming a hunter-killer seemed really compelling. With Signature as your number one defense, load her up with offensive weapons and go out and see if you can't blow a hole in the other guy's submarine fleet, his surface fleet, and his Air Force. especially if you do this far enough forward. You know, there's a cone of areas where the aircraft have to come through as an approaching fleet comes in, just based on range and tactical diameter. So if you can find that sweet spot and be under it in a way that they can't find you, and if they do find you, you know, the signature really gives you a triple. What we found is that it provides a triple return. You're hard to find, which means they have to dedicate a lot more resources if they want to find you. If they find you, you're hard to target, because then they have to go from an intelligence cueing sort of detection down to, no, I've actually got something I can lock a weapon onto. And then even if they get a shot off, you're hard to hit. The accuracy with which you would have to be targeted and the ability of the sensor that's now in the weapon to lock onto the ship is extremely low. So sending them out where you could really go after some of the high-end platforms and ideally pair them with submarines kind of became the new mission. So it took a year and a half, but we finally got her officially remissioned into what the Navy now calls surface strike, but it's really the traditional sea control mode. The other group that fell in love with the ship are the special ops guys. So her new secondary mission is SEAL support, because she can do a lot of things that the SEALs love to do. We can get their low observable craft in close enough to deploy them that it greatly reduces the fatigue that they face of open ocean transits and those things. Before Zumwalt, they were having to go 300 plus miles over open ocean in these small boats to gain the advantage they needed of their own low observability. Now we can get them much closer. We can carry the number of SEALs that they want for big missions. Submarines can get away with maybe 15. They want 40. With that 40 goes another 20 support people, medical, armorers, you name it. We can easily carry them and their command and control element. You get the above-water coverage of the electromagnetic spectrum, so easier to hear what the other guy's doing, pick up your own communications. Even if you're operating in very strict emission control, which these ships always do, you can still gain a lot passively by being above the water rather than under it. You can carry the boat, you can carry the aircraft they like to do, and she's also the world's largest floating skiff. The mission command center is entirely an SCI facility, which lets them use NSA-NET, which is their tool of choice. And then if they do get in trouble, she can bring some firepower to bear to help them get out. So the remissioning was pretty exciting.
Scott, you might, might talk about the hull design. Mm-hmm. It's very unusual, the advantage of the hull design versus the more traditional.
Sure. Yeah, we got time to do that. Actually, what I'll do is, if you want to talk hull. So she's got what's called a tumble home bow, which means it means a couple of things. First, she cuts through waves rather than riding over them. You think about the traditional flared bow. It's designed so that as the bow goes into the water, there's more and more air trap, more and more buoyancy effect, and you get the shape of the thing pushing up over the waves, right? Which makes it pretty miserable in high seas, but it makes it very survivable because all the forces are tending to bring the nose back up. These are designed to cut through the waves and provide the platform a lot more stability. But you have to understand the characteristics of the ship because it's also designed to drive itself underwater exactly once. It's like, and we had her, 20 knots, 25 knots through 20 foot seas is no problem in this ship. There's no way you'd want to do that in a traditional cruiser or destroyer. You just beat the thing to pieces. Extremely well built, extremely seaworthy, but you do have to understand the characteristics. The other two hull-related characteristics that matter first is her righting arm. So that when you design a ship, it's got something called a righting arm, which means that as an outside force pushes it over, your center of buoyancy and your center of gravity move away from each other, and the distance between the two of them that's working to right the ship is called the righting arm. On most ships, it's about 3 feet at 45 degrees, which is your max. Here, it's 13 feet. So they designed her to be incredibly stable in her vertical component because once you put those angles in play, you need them to stay relatively fixed with respect to the threat for them to get maximum advantage. That all sounds good, except the other thing they did was reduce her wake. If you look at those turns back there, a 17,000-ton ship moving at 30 knots should not be able to turn like that. To reduce her wake and reduce her susceptibility to wake-homing torpedoes, they also gave her a very, very shallow stern. So from about there back, it's almost at the waterline, but the rudders are still where they would traditionally be all the way back. So think of dipping your paddle in a canoe. You know, when she turns, she stays upright, and she kind of slides. but she can turn tighter than a ship half her weight. But that shallow stern means that she also, if you get big waves back there on her quarters, she can gather a lot of energy very quickly. And a lot of energy gathered plus a big riding arm working against it means that you can generate G-forces up here that will damage humans or equipment. So again, I'd be comfortable taking her out on days that I wouldn't even want to think of taking an Arleigh Burke out, and I've had one of those out in 80-foot seas.
80-foot?
Yeah, 7th Fleet sailed us right into a typhoon one time. So they can do 80 feet. It is a little intimidating, though, when you're on the bridge of a ship where you know you're 55 feet above the water level and you have to look up to see sky.
wow.
Yeah, they'll do it. Yeah, so extremely well built, but like any aircraft or any ship, you have to understand the characteristics and respect Mother Nature, because if you try to just buck up against her, she's going to win every time. Let's see, so we hit remissioning. So this is where we kind of transition, because as I mentioned, having so many industry partners from so many different types of companies, really small innovative defense companies all the way up to the major primes, plus the government civilian side, plus the Navy side, we really got a good look, a good practical look at what I had seen academically in the Pentagon, which is this hybrid warfare thing that the Chinese are bringing to the table. And we see a lot of data points scattered around the news, mostly it's cyber stuff, but when you see it all put together, you understand what's really happening. And I wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about that, because I think, you know, my world in the Navy, I noticed, had gone from when I came in, I could see most of the threats and targets that I was going to deal with on my own radar, and I could deal with them with the weapons I had on the ship. By the time I left, naval warfare spanned the entire ocean, and there was no safe harbor. Right? They can see you and they can strike you now at thousands of miles, so you fundamentally had to change. And I think the business world has kind of been the same way. You know, we went from a world where you could see your competition in trade shows, and competition was bounded by law, to a world now where companies are facing state-supported competition that is not respectful of law and is dedicated to make our companies extinct. So the way we kind of thought about it on the ship was this way, both tactically and in the business world. You started out in a world where most of your competition was up there in the slow and legal realm, and you had some illegal competition, but we knew how to deal with that. There were ways to hedge and insure against it, and you had the government to help you. We now live in a world where it's fast and legal, you know, all these disruptors, but it's also fast and illegal. Anybody who hasn't taken time to read the Chinese intelligence law that was passed in 2017 that makes it a legally mandated for Chinese companies to work with their intelligence services should take a look at that. And the other thing I'd recommend you read is called Unrestricted Warfare, which they published in 1999 and lays out the plan that that they followed ever since in terms of not facing us through traditional competition, but going after what they see as our weaknesses, which is our allegiance to law and order and separation of government and public and, you know, public-private. So in business, and this Rob Replicate Replace, credit for that goes to the FBI. They actually came up with that term, but I think it's absolutely correct. Cyber is one small dot in this plan. First, they're coming after you, and they've published China 2025, which lists the industries they're most interested in. Aerospace is first and foremost among them, especially as you ease towards things that are automated and on the cutting edge of aerospace. But they've stated publicly that by 2025, they want to be world leader in aerospace. So robbing goes well beyond cyber. They are using all of the tradecraft that you would normally see in state-to-state interactions in intelligence to come after our companies and get IP, get people, you name it. Of the cyber attacks that are successful, only 15% of them or so are technical penetrations. 85% of them are enabled by human factors. So somebody inside or somebody, you know, either willingly or unknowingly assisting. So cyber is necessary, but not at all sufficient. And then they replicate it. So they're government labs, they're subsidizing, they're state-owned industries. You know, they're going to race you to market with your own stuff. And while they're doing that, they're going to actively undermine your position in the market. They're going to come after your board. They're going to come after your supply chain. They're going to come after public perception of your company. They're going to do everything they can to lay the groundwork for their entry, which is the replace part. And there you'll see more subsidization, sometimes active attacks, lawfare, information outs. So anybody who is in one of the industries in particular that are on the China 2025 list, I would encourage them to think of themselves as a company facing a country. And what can you do about it? I think the biggest thing is have a narrative that your team understands. You know, I became the evangelizer in chief of my crew being professionally paranoid and seeing themselves as team members with industry. Because if they got through industry, it didn't matter that they didn't get through us. That was going to be a difference without a distinction. We were all going to fail. So we really had to have an entire, what you'd say, an entire supply chain team approach, where everybody was covering everybody else's back and everybody was asking tough questions. And that they had to understand that they had kind of a no safe harbor situation on their hands. There was no, just because we weren't operating in the Western Pacific didn't mean that we weren't going to face almost the same level of challenge that we would if we were in active combat in the Western Pacific. Outcome-focused thinking, which I will... So government in particular loves rules-based thinking, but as long as you follow the rules, that's sufficient. Shifting people from that to an outcome-focused, you know, what are we trying to do, rather than are we following the rules? The government loves, well, the government has an atmosphere that almost by definition, if you follow the rules, you've done the right thing. So we worked really hard to get a lot of rules changed, because you can't just break them, but you do have to identify when they're no longer sufficient to need, particularly in terms of this type of a competition. And then,
could you say, because I think that sure. Outcome focusing, how, what kind of things did you do that shifted people from the traditional rules to this new way of thinking? What kind of things did you that caused it shift, the crew to shift?
Well, the thing that made us realize that we had to shift was, it was actually cybersecurity, because the Navy plan for cybersecurity on that ship was 3 years old. And the Naval Sea Systems Command answer every time we recognized a new vulnerability was, "Hey, I'm meeting my requirement." So we this is being recorded, isn't it? found some friends from back in D.C. that were willing to hack the ship for us. So ethical hackers, if you will, without the Navy knowing about it, and they got deep enough into it that the report on that made it to the National Security Council in about 24 hours and came back down to the Navy at the CNO level.
How did you get the crew to think differently? That's the administration, but...
Lots and lots of red teaming. Everywhere that we knew there was a threat, we picked some of our most creative sailors and set them up as an almost unfettered red team. I mean, my rules were I didn't want to know what they were going to do to us next because I was part of the response force. And that ranged from terrorism all the way to more traditional types of responding to mechanical or electrical or computer failures. So the ship was, always in a training environment.
So I'm assuming the direction you gave to that team was in terms of the outcome desired.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically just don't break any laws.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, the XO and I had, my second command, the XO and I had a great relationship. If they were worried that they were pushing it too far, they could always go to him and just ask for a sanity check. And then we did a lot of debriefs and analysis and changing procedures based on how those came out.
Another question really pertains to your prior slide. So the U.S. and China just signed an agreement. And the most important part of that for many people, besides getting rid of the tariffs and so on, is the IP,
mm-hmm.
which seems to have no teeth in it, but mm-hmm. that's the big question. Based on what you've said, that ROB part is crucial to the future of China,
mm-hmm.
and I can't imagine them ever agreeing to give that up.
Nope.
So that the agreement probably isn't going to be very effective.
No,
at least as far as the IP goes.
I think it'll be zero effective. the, I mean, terminology matters, and we use the word competition. In their own writing, they use the term war. They see this as a war. They're fighting it by other means than military, but their goal is to push us out of the Pacific, push us off the top shelf in terms of, well, I think they want to fundamentally change the way the international system works from the system that was developed after World War II. When we get into the Q&A, I'll be glad to go into more of that, but yeah, they see a fundamental revision of the world order. They don't want to come fly the Chinese flag over the White House, but they do want a world where the Chinese flag flies equal to the American flag, and maybe higher than it in many parts.
Would you then say that the primary competition for the U.S. is China and not Russia?
Yes. I think Russia is a failing power that is doing what it can to secure a place on the stage. China is... I had the good fortune when I was at Stanford to work with George Shultz for a year, and one of his favorite sayings was, if you think managing a rising China is tough, wait till you got to manage a failing China. But certainly China's vision of itself is a rising power that is returning to a rightful place in the world. And U.S. leadership of the world is mutually exclusive to China having its place in the world that it thinks it deserves. All right. Oops. And that's it. Subject to your questions.
Yeah. That's the best quote from our commissioning day.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, who's the primary contractor for the
building? General Dynamics is the primary for the hull, and Raytheon is the primary for the network and weapon systems. Yes, sir.
I had a question, and thank you so much for your insight. This is just amazing. Now, with all the drone technology and all the technology that people are using today, if you look out 5-10 years from now, dealing with, you know, these international threats, do you see drone technology on unmanned ships as a long-term solution for reconnaissance and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to happen a lot faster than anybody believes it's going to happen. It's already happening in a lot of areas. You said unmanned drones on unmanned ships?
No, unmanned ships for reconnaissance.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There are a couple of neat companies out there. Thayer Mahan is one. Ocean Arrow is one right down in San Diego that are doing sail-based, solar-powered stuff that can stay out for months. Wow. And can drag sensors around that. Yeah, it's cheaper. It's yeah, it's coming fast.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So this is the first of a series of craft or vessels. Are there?
Yeah,
plans?
Great question. I should have mentioned that. So we started with a plan for 32 of them, and then through budget and other reductions, we went to like 27, 24. It was 18, 17, 12, 8, 4, 3, 0, and then back to 3. So 3 is the answer right now. It may wind up being 2 because the third ship is still up in Bath, and I think we've taken enough spare parts off of her that finishing her may be cost ineffective. We'll see. There's not going to be more than 3 of these. Of the 12 technologies that they built into her, probably 5 of them are really super good, and there's another 3 that are okay, and then there's some that are just terrible. So 3 is probably the right number, but we need to learn everything we can and harvest those good ones and build them into the next class of ship. This class will be a complete success if the next class of ships that we build, large surface combatants, look a lot like them and have the best characteristics built into them. But there's some things that it just, you know, they put 2 different turbine sizes in her, to give you one example, which makes no sense. So you've got 2 large Rolls-Royce turbines and then you've got 2 small ones. Why wouldn't you go with 4 of the same size? You know, different supply chain, different training, you know, the whole logistics thing that goes with that. Anyway, there are some things that you also will see wildly different prices for the ship quoted. The actual price of building that ship was about $4.3 billion. You'll see prices, you know, costs up to 8-point-some billion, and it really, both are correct if you treat the R&D differently. So we did $12 billion in R&D for the class, and out of that spread across three hulls, you know, you get up to the $8 billion a copy number. The actual building price of the first one was about 4.3. I think the second one's going to come in about 3.9, and the third one should be about 3.5. If you build 12 of them, they don't cost any more than the other ships that we're building them. So there is economy of scale, and when you disrupt industry badly by changing all those numbers around, you get increased rates. Other questions? Yes, sir.
So I'm actually trying to formulate these questions. This is a tremendous paradigm shift within the Navy, within a relatively regimented coastal environment. In my opinion, I've been in the Navy, but in that sense, what are the key factors that essentially facilitate and allow this to occur? Outside of being part of the radar, or this isn't normally something that you see occur. So what are the key elements? I think all of this, especially our business, it's stating that they can't follow the rules, they can just follow suit, will be okay. Eventually, their GM, their CEOs, their GE, etc. But it's critical that organizations have elements within them that allows this essentially entrepreneurial pressure.
Mm-hmm. One thing. It was very much top-down driven. Admiral Vern Clark, when he was Chief of Naval Operations, made this happen. And he partly made it happen because, remember that year 1992, he felt exactly the way you just described about the Navy as an institution and wanted to intentionally shake things up by doing something substantially different, not knowing how it would come out, but knowing that by shaking the tree a little bit, something good would likely happen. He also felt enabled to do that because they knew strategically we had at least a little bit of breathing room. They could afford to make mistakes. The Soviet Union was gone. There was no competitor immediately on the horizon that couldn't be dealt with the existing force. So they did think that they had a unique strategic inflection point that allowed them to do something a little crazy. But yeah, this would not have been a bottom-up design in the Navy.
Sort of a follow-up to that. I mean, you mentioned, you know, it's a partnership between Navy and private sector. Some of the private sector has some of those same challenges. But yeah. Do you think that shaking the tree and, does it have ripple effects? Do you think that changed it so things are a little more agile? Or what is needed to make it so that we continue to be, in light of the threats we have, that we continue to be responsive and forward-thinking and stay ahead of them?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think just the opposite. Mm-hmm. I think there's this saying in the Pentagon, Zumwalt fatigue, mm-hmm. That this has been a headache, and the challenges of getting something so unique out to the fleet has caused people to do a lot more push-ups and spend a lot more time talking to Congress than they would have had to if they'd gone with a safe, easy, traditional ship type. So while my hope is that they will take a lot of these ideas and put them into the next class of ship because that's exactly what we need, I think the chances of that actually happening are relatively low. I think this has reinforced people's sense that there's really no personal upside, but there's a lot of career risk for me if I do something out of the norm. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for your presentation. I kind of have two questions. The first one is, now that it's here, and maybe in the last decade, how much competitive analysis has been done, and has any of this been stolen? And then kind of a whole different question. I'd like to hear if you put any advanced manufacturing on the ship, 3D printing or replacement parts or anything that's kind of cool from our perspective.
Mm-hmm. So we know some things were stolen. The whole stealth thing was new to the surface Navy, and so they did a great job designing a stealth ship, but didn't put a whole lot of work into how to manage a stealth ship. So we went and lashed ourselves up with the Air Force guys that operate stealth aircraft and learned a lot from them in terms of how you protect that signature. And if you're stealthy, you don't want to run around stealthy all the time. You want people to have to guess what your real signature is, so how do you dirty her up? So the crew, that was a crew initiative, and again, it took us took us a year, and we had to get a letter signed by the 4-star Pacific Fleet Commander to get the Navy to recognize that protecting your signature was actually something that was a requirement to having these types of ships. And then how you operate a stealth platform. Has some of it been stolen? Yeah, unfortunately, so much of the, especially on the industry side, the design was done on unclassified networks. Again, going back to the 90s, when the initial R&D was done, all that was out there on the internet. A lot of it's since been moved, but it's undoubtedly a lot of it has been stolen. So how long will it be before somebody else produces something similar? I would guess not too long. And what was additive manufacturing. The crew did go out and get a couple of 3D printers. The Navy right now has a big push on experimenting with additive manufacturing, which I think is way overdue. The challenges that we have are just the way that we love checklists for operating. We love requirements with regard to replacement parts. So I would see them making things like doorknobs right now, but making anything that's going to go into any kind of a system that hasn't been mil-spec'd and hasn't been, until we figure out how to get mil-spec certification of locally manufactured parts, I think there's going to be a barrier to getting the full return out of those that we could. Now we have a little company at UC San Diego that is working with a company up at USC that has figured out how to, from a ship, you can now order a part the same way you would through the supply system, but what they actually do is go to the OEM, license a copy of the print, and then 3D print it on the ship.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It's very cool. If we can make that work, then it's just a matter of certifying that the material is the material it's supposed to be.
And doing that securely, by the way.
Yeah.
And we're all going to be faced with that industry.
Yeah.
Once that IP is ripped and anybody can print your design, now suddenly you don't have your IP anymore.
Yep. So I have a quick question for you. You were talking about all these different ships and areas that work. What's the typical tenure of someone like you that's managing all these ships and infrastructure? Is there like a mandatory retirement age in the Navy for people that work in the administration area like you're talking about?
There is a mandatory retirement age. I think it's 60. But it gets waived, and those are your senior admirals that are hitting up against that. So what we have is kind of a maximum length of service based on your pay grade. So if you're a lieutenant commander 04 major type, you're done at 20, I think. I think it's 04, 05, 06 is can stay to 30. And then if you're a flag or general officer, you can stay until you turn 60 or you get a waiver.
But basically 60, you're out for the most part.
What I'm particularly interested in is the leadership lessons and challenges that you faced and how you overcame them. I'm really impressed with you as a leader, having met your crew. You can tell a lot about the leader. And you got basically, as far as I could tell, a bunch of highly competent, very happy, energetic, and inventive people. And I've heard some of the lessons. I mean, that's what I'm interested in, is sharing what are some of the lessons you learned about leading people. For example, one of the things I heard you talk about was you were concerned about every crew member and their career.
Mm-hmm.
You took a personal interest in how were they going to progress in their life. I think that's not something we traditionally see in civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
So can you speak to some of the leadership lessons or the leadership guidelines that you use in this highly innovative environment?
The most important thing was the narrative, making sure they understood the importance of what they were doing and where they fit in it, because they were doing a lot of things that were unpleasant and they were working harder than their peers across the peer were. The Navy has these duty cycles, so ships are never uncrewed. In general, a ship in port, every sixth day, you'll have to stay 24 hours. So you'll get your duty day on Zumwalt. Because of the crew number, it's either 3 or 4 days. Every 3 or 4 days, you're stuck on board. That plus the nature of the work being a little bit more demanding, a lot more time-consuming, We knew we were going to have a problem where, so the way that the Navy system works, it's kind of a discussion between the Navy personnel office and the sailor about where the sailor is going to go next. And we knew that there was no sailor in their right mind that was of high caliber that was going to vote to come to some place that was harder if it also wasn't more rewarding. So we faced the prospect of word getting out that, hey, you're going to have more duty days, you're going to work harder, and oh, by the way, if life sucks, we would wind up in a death spiral where you'd get less and less qualified sailors because it would be only the people that could be forced to these classes of ships. So from day one, we really did do everything we could to make sure that this was an assignment that people wanted to fight for. And the only way that we had to do that was by taking an interest in their career, because I can't give bonuses. I can't. The only way I can give a kid more money is to get them promoted. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time looking at each individual, what career milestones they needed by way of professional qualifications, leadership positions, all the things that the Navy was going to look at on their promotion board and make sure that they checked all the blocks. And we gave away probably more awards than I normally would have on a different ship, just to set them up. And by doing that, we had, you know, quite often we beat the fleet rate by 50% in terms of the number of people that were promoting on a given cycle to the next higher rank. And we also did a lot of evangelism inside the Navy to make sure that people understood that sailors that were on this ship were faced with different tasks, were working harder, so that on the side of those that were making promotion decisions, there was already an inclination towards rewarding some all sailors. Just giving them a chance to innovate. And we moved aboard the ship, and I kid you not, so normally there's about a three-month period from the day the Navy signs the delivery papers to the day the crew moves aboard, because when you deliver a ship, none of the stuff that you need to run the ship is aboard. Right? It's literally a hull. You know, there's no mattresses, there's no toilet paper, there's no food, there's no fire hoses. All that stuff is Navy provided. We moved aboard the day the Navy signed the delivery paper. Again, we were under a lot of political schedule pressure. And the second that they finished signing, the crane started moving these tri-wall, huge cardboard boxes of all this stuff that then everybody in the crew started breaking out and just moving around the ship. And it took us weeks to get it all neatly stowed, but we got it aboard, moved it around. We broke open the containers that had the cleaning gear, and it was World War II era, what we call foxtails, these crazy little hand brooms, stamped steel dustpans that were so warped from being moved around that you couldn't even use them on the deck. You know, and we're looking at this going, you got to be shitting me. I mean, I got 150 people. I got twice the space that a crew twice the size would normally have to handle. So we got some of the chiefs and some of the sailors together and said, hey, you know, the standard is the standard for very good reason. The ship is going to be clean. But obviously we can't do it this way, because the week one we were spending well over 200 man hours a day just on general cleanliness. We said, hey, we got to get this down below 80. So we got sailors together and said, hey, you know, how you want to do it? We're going to meet the standard. How y'all want to do it? And the commissioning committee coughed up a little slush fund, so they just started Googling stuff, and before you know it, we had Roombas running around at night, and they had the Dyson stick vacs, which was what they finally settled on, is that the Dyson stick vac was the way to go, because it was easy to use. They could keep it in their stateroom, so they could use it to clean their stateroom as well as the general purpose areas. And because it was battery powered, it didn't have to go through the Navy's electrical safety check thing. They could sign it out like personal electronics, because the Navy, if you're using anything that plugs directly into a socket, you have to get it from the electricians. So the electrician, before they can issue it, has to do a check on it, and then they just sign it out to you. So, you know, there's a limited number of hours a day that those things are open and available, and the kids got to go wait in line. But with the Dysons, they could keep in their room, and they had access to it, so they could clean whenever they wanted.
So they let the crew innovate. I mean, it sounded like, here's the problem. You guys go off and figure out a solution rather than doing a solution from the top down.
Yeah. I didn't have the time to do top-down solutions, and I would have come up with worse solutions. So letting them do it worked pretty well.
You know, you said that one of the important things was the narrative. Can you say a little bit more about or an example of what you mean by we had a narrative and that knew where they were or not?
Every sailor on that ship could talk in an educated manner about the U.S.'s competition with China, how the U.S. Navy fit in that competition, how the ship fit into the Navy, and why it was vital to get these ships out to the fleet in terms of the mission that they were going to do. And they could walk you through that logic chain so that they understood that their contribution to that ship really rolled all the way up into this national geoeconomic competition. And that made doing some of the unpleasant things a little bit more palatable.
So they knew the big picture, the purpose of the whole thing.
Yep.
They were bought into the purpose, or they wouldn't have been in the Navy in the first place. And then you created this thing where they could see what they were doing today hooked into that greater purpose. Mm-hmm.
The Navy today, especially in the wake of the two collisions, I think has taken exactly the wrong approach. You hear this, well, we've got to crawl before we can walk and walk before we can run, meaning that we need to focus on all these basic skills. We got to get the engineering right. We got to get the maintenance right. And then we'll worry about teaching them tactics. If the kid doesn't understand the warfighting mission first, then they have no reason to be good at the rest of it. Right? So we started with, this is the purpose, this is the mission, and all these other things that we have to do enable that mission.
Now that links up, if you might be familiar with Simon Sinek, Start With Why.
Yeah.
And that seems like what you're saying.
We also had, and you and I have had this discussion before, yeah. We had representatives of all four generations that are in the workforce today in the crew. So I had a 54-year-old Chief Warrant Officer 5 was my head crippy, who was a solid boomer in all regards. He was happy as a clam if you told him what to do and when to do it by. He'd march off and do it. But then on the other end, we had the young millennials and the, I guess they're Zers, that didn't want to be told what to do. They wanted to be told, well, they didn't want to be told how to do it. They wanted to be told what to do and why they were doing it, and then be left alone to go figure out how to do it on their own. And as long as you knew which generation you were talking to, I loved my millennials. I thought they were fantastic. They'd kill themselves once they understood why they were doing it, and especially if you could make it a bit of a challenge for them.
Wendy, one last question here. I think we're running up against our 9 o'clock timeline here. So
we started talking about it a little bit, but this goes along with the McCain-Gerald accident, and it seems like to me that the leadership over there, at least in the Pacific, has some competency issues, like we were starting to talk about. But it feels like also that the Navy doesn't really get kind of, I think of it as asymmetric warfare or the hybrid warfare you're talking about. Can you talk about that a little bit more and kind of give me your ideas on that and what you're thinking about? Is the Navy taking the correct steps to fix these problems? I mean, they wrecked 2 destroyers.
Yeah.
They killed,
30-odd people total.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is just really ridiculous when we're not in war. You ran into a tanker, right? And what I think about here is I think about our thoughts when we went into Iraq in the Army, in the Marines, in the military, going in there, like, oh, we'll just take it. We're just going to go fight this war the way we've been fighting wars, which is war changes. And so, would you mind talking about that a little bit?
Sure, I'll do it as quick as I can.
It's kind of a lot.
It is a lot. So first off, McCain and Fitzgerald are 2 totally different circumstances. Fitzgerald mm-hmm. was a broken culture and a huge competency problem. McCain was confusion and, I would say, a default to a checklist mentality. When they thought they had a... So Fitzgerald's accident started 3 days before it happened. Just a series of blunders and a really bad command culture. McCain thought that they had a rudder failure that had jammed the rudder to the left. Turns out that it was operator error and whatnot. But at any rate, they followed their checklist, which was, oh, I've lost steering. Slow down. No, speed up. Right? So that the checklist mentality of verbatim compliance with procedure is kind of what caught them, I would say. There is a lot of cultural inertia, and I guess the shortest way I can say it is I expect the opening days or weeks of the next naval war to be extremely embarrassing for the U.S. Navy, because we are not thinking about fighting differently, and if we don't, yeah, it's going to we're not talking asymmetric weapons. We're talking anti-ship missiles that have been around since the 60s. They've just improved, and we've never quite gotten our head around what that means for warfare, even in the wake of the Falklands. So you multiply that by hypersonics and all this other stuff.
A lot of technology at play. Well, I want to thank Captain Scott. Let's give him a round of applause. I think what's so amazing here is we're faced with this business. We have to think differently. There's a lot of disruption, and a headcount is always the focus in any organization. And I know there's these perspectives about what the generations offer. I'm bullish about the future and the future generations, and I like to have the mix to think differently, to disrupt ourselves. But isn't it amazing to be committed to a mission and to know where we're going and do that on a ship and think of that as your business and how we operate? I think that's the best. So thank you, Scott.
My pleasure. Thank you all for having me.